Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Neil Templin is a tightwad. Just ask him. He chronicles all the ways he does not part with his money and all the lessons he's learned in the process in a Wall Street Journal column called, appropriately, Cheapskate. Impervious to the impulse buy and not picking up the check. This hour On Point, Confessions of a Skinflint. You can join the conversation. Are you a cheapskate? Do you admit it with pride? And now that thrift is fashionable again, are the skinflints having their day? What about the flip side? When is spending money the better choice? Joining me now is Neil Templin. He's the Wall Street Journal's personal finance editor. And since June 2008, he's written a column about his adventures and misadventures in holding on to his money. It's called Cheapskate. Neil Templin, welcome to On Point.
Well, thank you. Hi, Jane.
Hi. So what was the genesis of your column?
Well, to be honest, it wasn't something I'd thought about at all very far back, but just shortly before I started, one of the editors who knew I was sort of a penny pincher said they'd had an idea for a long time to do a column called Cheapskate, and maybe I'd be the right person to do it. So I just sat down and wrote about five or six of them and thought they weren't too bad and decided I would give it a go.
Has the crummy economy put some wind behind your sails? Are tightwads feeling vindicated after watching people fritter away their money for so many years?
I think definitely that we were in an age of really, you know, excess consumption, and now we're going the other direction. So I think there is more interest in saving money and you know, just being more careful and more efficient just generally. So, yes.
So in this economic climate, what columns do readers respond to most, Neil?
Well, it's really not the practical ones where I'll give advice. Like one column I said I wrote about how to refinance your mortgage and how to game it to get the lowest rate. It didn't get a lot of feedback. It tends to be more the ones where I talk about the interactions with my wife, Clarissa, who is not a cheapskate, and sort of how I try to be a cheapskate and how she foils me and so forth. And those are just the ones. I think people really want insights into a personal life, and they want to see the two of us going back and forth more than they want just tips. I think most people actually know how to save money, you know, spend less, and so forth on their own. They just they like to see the friction that it causes in a marriage.
We'll talk to Clarissa about that in just a bit. I wondered if you'd tell us about some of your other columns, the columns that get the most heated response. I know the Costco column got people quite upset in this economic climate. Tell me why.
I wrote a column in which I suggested that perhaps you don't save money by going to Costco. The reason is because they sell in such large quantities, it tends to make you purchase a lot more than you ordinarily might, and I argued perhaps in some occasions consume more. So if you buy a huge package of bagels, you're going to tend to eat a bunch more bagels, give them to friends and so forth, whereas if you bought fewer of them at a higher price at a bagel shop, you might actually not only eat less bagels, but may in the end spend less money. It got people have very strong feelings towards Costco, and people got very upset with any suggestion that going to Costco might not be a smart thing to do or might cost them money. And I got, you know, probably 100 or 150 emails, just some of them very, very belligerent on that point.
People were generally proud of what they thought of being smart consumers, I guess.
That's right. I mean, it's part of their image. They think I go to Costco, I save money, it's a positive thing I do, and how dare you suggest that it's wasteful. But, you know, it was funny for that column. I actually interviewed the CFO for Costco, Richard Galanti, a very open guy, and he said, you know, he sort of agreed with the thesis that people do tend to consume more. But then he went on to say, but if you're disciplined about what you buy, then it can be a good deal. And that's, and I'm pretty much in agreement on that. If you're very disciplined at Costco, it's great. If you're not, it can be sort of a disaster.
You also get a huge response, Neil Templin, when you write about tipping, especially at restaurants. Can you tell us about that?
Tipping is quite interesting. Tipping levels used to run about 10% in the 1950s, then went up to about 15%, say, in the 70s, and now commonly are sort of heading towards 20%. The average tip is about 18%. And so I usually tip 15, sometimes 20. I thought I was a pretty good tipper, and it turns out I'm not. And I sort of wanted to explore why tipping levels have gone up over time, and it turns out I talked to a tipping expert at Cornell, and he said people tip to get approval from the people they're with in their party and from the waiters, and the way you do that is you tip a little more than the next guy, and so they tend to be pushing up over time. They think eventually they may be running more, closer into the above 20, towards 25%.
A lesson that you learned as a busboy, in a little restaurant in L.A., California?
San Diego area, but yeah, I mean, I wrote this with some sympathy for the other side, because my last job before becoming a professional journalist was working as a busboy in an Iranian-owned restaurant during the Iranian hostage crisis. And it was sort of a crazy experience, and we would share in the waiter's tips. So I know people in the service industry work terrifically hard for their tips, but I just find it very interesting. My wife and I differ on this, and if someone gives bad service, like I will give them a 10% tip, or if it's really horrible, maybe no tip at all, but she feels pressured to give them a pretty good tip almost regardless of service.
We'll ask her about that when she comes on in a few minutes. Tell us the last story in this block, I think, about the column you wrote about buying a pair of Nike shoes. What happened? Yeah.
Well, I guess about a year and a half or so ago, I bought some Nike running shoes, and I don't actually run. I walk a lot and run some sprints sometimes, but I don't jog per se. And so I had always bought New Balance shoes previously, and the things would last basically forever. And so I bought these Nike shoes, and I had them for 4 months, and one of the eyelets broke. And it's actually very difficult to use a shoe when an eyelet breaks. One lace, it's almost impossible to tie it to your foot, or so I thought. And so, well, I figured, okay, I know how retailing works. I just go back to the store and tell them, and they'll give me a new pair and so forth, because it's so common these days. And I went back to this local running shoe store in Dallas where I was living at the time. And no, you know, 4-month-old shoe to them was sort of an old shoe. Some people buy new shoes every month. I don't know. Who, I don't know, but apparently they said that was common.
Not a cheapskate, that's for sure.
Not a cheapskate, right. And so but they said, talk to – but Nike is just very good at working with customers. So call them up. So I called them up, and they said, okay, mail them in. We'll take a look, and we'll see if it was our problem or your problem. And I thought, well, the code word for that is if you're not trying to scam them, and I wasn't, that they'll give you a new pair of shoes or something. So I mail them in, which cost me like $7, and I hear nothing. And then, lo and behold, the shoes get mailed back to me, and they said, basically, hey, we did everything right. We're not going to do anything.
And then you wrote about this experience in your column.
I did, and I wrote, and I thought I was tried to be fair to Nike. I put their response in, and then, of course, when I called them up and told them what I'd gone through as a consumer, they went and checked and said, oh, those shoes did have a flaw or something, and we should have exchanged them. We're very sorry. So I put that in the column, and got tremendous response from people just on this whole subject of returns. There were more people out there than I was aware of that were upset at Nike over shoe issues. But just generally, people are – I think a number of retailers are getting tougher in terms of returns and so forth. And I got it from the other end, too. I had some people that were avid runners and said, you big baby, how in the world could you ever think you could return running shoes after 4 months? I buy them every month or two, just like the running shoe store guy said.
And then Reebok sent you, what, a dozen pair or something?
Reebok sent me, trying to be cute, sent me unsolicited like 4 or 5 pairs of shoes from every size from 9 to 12. I happen to be a 13, but any event, I wouldn't have kept it. I because we don't keep any gifts, so I mailed them all back. And then Nike, of course, even though I told them I did not want anything, because when I go as a journalist, I'm really not trying to get favorable treatment for myself, sent me a coupon for, I think, $92 or something, and I had to mail that back. So,
do you attribute your penny-pinching, cheapskate mentality to nature or nurture? Were you born this way? Have you always wanted to squeeze out every last bit of money you can?
I think it's a combination, both thinking about my own life and my own environment and then talking to the experts in the subject. And I think they say that if you grow up with cheap parents, you're more likely to be cheap, but you're also influenced by circumstances in your life. And it is true. It was very frugal for us when I was a kid. My father actually became a physics professor, but he was going to school, and so we had very little money when I was a little kid, and I was the eldest child. But then after I got married, it was once again the same circumstance. I was a reporter making very little money and had kids relatively young, and so, you know, we had three kids on a pretty on one salary at one point, and so you sort of had to be frugal or go into debt.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. To spend or not to spend? That's the question we're discussing this hour. We're talking with Neil Templin, personal finance editor of the Wall Street Journal. He writes the journal's column Cheapskate about his lifelong commitment to not spending his money. I'd like to bring another guest in now. Clarissa Templin is Neil's wife of nearly 30 years. We wanted to know what life is like with a cheapskate, especially if you're not one. Clarissa Templin, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Thank you.
Thank you. Did you initially have any reservations about your life being exposed in Neil's columns?
It sounds terrible, but I really didn't think it was going to be read by a lot of people. I thought maybe his parents, me, I don't know, a couple of friends.
Yeah.
I've been sort of surprised. And, I mean, I'm not trying to be mean. I just thought, let's try it and see what happens. But I never really thought it was going to be me in it. It's like a stranger. And I have nothing to do with it.
So does he represent your side of the story fairly and accurately when it comes to family finances?
Most of the time, yes. The only time that I had a complaint was when he put on the Valentine's column when he said that I said that, I wanted something extravagant. When he was asking me about that, I felt sort of like it was leading the witness, Your Honor, kind of a situation, because he was asking me, he's pretty fair, but... when I said, women want something special on Valentine's Day, something out of the ordinary, something, and then he interjected extravagant, extravagant, and guess what made it into the column, the extravagant part.
Nicely edited. How have you negotiated, how have you negotiated life with a cheapskate, Clarissa?
Deep closets, where you can hide some of your purchases for one thing, getting to the mailbox before he does. It's been a lot of push and pull, but he's a really nice guy. He's very forgiving of all my foibles, and he's very loving.
Are there areas after all these years, 30 years of marriage, you still disagree when it comes to money?
Oh, definitely. Are you kidding? The only thing is that he's a little bit more pliable now. So he tends to see my side more than he used to, and I tend to see his side more. You know, one of the things that has happened with the column, actually, which is funny, it's made our marriage a little bit better, because by asking me a lot of questions, he's finally gotten to listen to my side, and at the same time, by reading some of what the experts say about why he's a cheapskate, have made me understand a little bit more of why he does it. It's not because he wants to make my life impossible, but because it's something innate in him.
I was interested to read in many of the columns about you two going to restaurants together. What happens when you walk into a restaurant, Clarissa?
The first thing I do is look at the appetizer and when they hand us the menu, and you can feel the tension in the air. You know, it's like he's staring at you, sort of like saying, move on to the entree. Let's not waste time or money with the appetizers. So that's one of the things. And then, of course, tipping comes around. But he's gotten better about tipping.
Is this true, Neil?
More or less.
More or less? What's more, what's less?
Well, it's all true. And the one thing I've noticed, and I might write a column in this vein at some point, is I actually... in writing the column has made me somewhat less cheap. And on some things I've had to think about, you know, like I have been tipping a little more lavishly lately because I realize it's going to working people, but I'm more evolving towards being cheap in that I just, the things I don't want, I just don't buy, but the things I do want, I've found myself a little less cheap in the last few months thinking about the topic.
I found it interesting to read how you ceded control of the family finances to Clarissa. You turned over the money, turned over the checkbook to your wife. First of all, Clarissa, how much responsibility did you feel knowing your husband's cheapskate ways, knowing his feelings about money? What was the response from your part?
Before we go into the response, let's go into the real reason why he did it. One time, balancing the checkbook, he couldn't figure out why he was $100 off. And this was when we didn't have that much money. $100 was a lot of money. And he couldn't figure it out. So he said, you figure it out. And after that, it was my decisions. You know, what? And I was the one in charge of the smaller part of the budget. You know, I really didn't feel like it was a responsibility. It was more like a chore at the time.
Neil, what about the money management issues in a marriage? A strategic choice for you? And when you write about this, what's the response you get from your readers?
Well, yeah, I might add, I mean, to what Clarissa's saying, I mean, partly, I think there's an interesting, when you have a single wage earner supporting the house, which is the case in ours, and if that person then is in charge of all the day-to-day spending, I think it tends to make the person, in this case Clarissa, feels sort of not very powerless, as if they're totally beholden to you. Because we have gone back, I mean, the incident she gives you is absolutely true, but we've gone back and forth over the years, and she really likes the system where she keeps control of day-to-day spending, and I'm more in charge of, like, spending on or saving for retirement and getting the best deal on a mortgage and the sort of big long-term stuff. And so I think those forces are at play. But I also think the other factor is, if you're being strategic, and part of my goals is to get Clarissa not to spend too much, it's more successful if she's the one that has to pay all the bills every month and has to sweat through paying everything. So, I mean, that was part of what drove what I do, is I realized if she's doing it, she'll spend less. If I try to control everything, she'll just find ways of running around me, and we'll end up spending more. Now, in terms of response from readers, sure, I got a bunch from that one, and amazingly, our system, which I thought was sort of unique to us, and turns out to be not all that uncommon. There's a lot of people like that out there, and yeah, it was a pretty interesting column for me to write.
Let me bring some callers into this conversation now. First, from Cambridge, Massachusetts, Bill's on the line. Hi, Bill. Welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi.
Good, thanks. I come from a long line of cheapskates. I'll just run through a quick list here.
Okay.
First of all, make it yourself. Reuse before you recycle. I made an excellent thermos out of a jelly jar, newspaper, cardboard, a hat, and a bread bag. I have made cell phone covers out of toilet paper rolls, tape, and magic markers, which saved me $30 each. Mm. I kept a couple of pairs of boots going for 30 or 40 years. That's in the category of if you own it, fix it. And I don't buy cheap. I buy really good boots and then take excellent care of them so they last forever. I always carry food when I leave the house. I won't end up hungry and have to buy junk from someplace, and never buy that bottled water. Get a filter, save a bottle, carry it yourself.
Have you always been this way, Bill?
I have to admit it.
Yes.
Yes, I have. I have, and even when I've had a good job and I've been doing well, I don't change. Mm. You know, I might buy food out once in a while more often, but one thing I always do is I tip people. I'm very kind to waiters and waitresses, and I tip them well because they're doing a job that I couldn't stand.
Bill, thanks for the call. The evolution of a cheapskate, Neil Templin. That's an interesting thought. Have you changed over the years?
Yeah, I think I was really hyper cheap when we first got married. It was just we were on so little money. About, you know, I earned $12,000 a year, and Carissa earned $10,000, and we had a child, and we were trying to save for a car and do all the stuff. And I think I would really get worried about stuff. Now I tend not to worry quite as much on a lot of things because I realize saving $5 or $10 doesn't really matter all that much because you're going to get whacked with some bill for thousands of dollars to deal with your house repair or whatever. So I think I've evolved more towards keeping an eye on the big things and not always worrying about the little things. I think that's probably the biggest way I've changed.
I'm looking at one of the columns. Clarissa, chime in here that Neil wrote about your honeymoon trip to Monterey.
Oh, yes.
And the meal that you ordered at that little restaurant. Do you recall?
Oh, yes, I do. I sure do.
And what was the story?
Well, you know, it was one of those things where they give us the menu, and Neil, you know, they start reading the specials, which was ribs, and this was a seafood restaurant. So I start opening the menu, and he says, close the menu. And I said, but I haven't seen what there is. There's a special. It's ribs. And I said, I don't want ribs. I don't like ribs that much.
And right? It's $8, right? And that's why we came into this restaurant. Because you saw it on the sign
like
on the outside, yeah?
And anyway, so he ended up ordering the ribs. I ended up ordering fish. And he got, like, this, I don't know what kind of ribs they were, but they were incredibly small and no meat in them, and I had fish. And it was very good fish, by the way. But that's when I learned just how cheap it was, that especially in a restaurant. I had grown up that you go to a restaurant, you have a good time, you order something that, you know, feels good to eat, and he didn't.
Does being a cheapskate, Neil Templin, deny you certain pleasures that, you know, in some cases you really can afford? And do you regret that?
Yes. There have definitely been times where I've done without things that I would have liked to have had, and afterwards you think, well, that was sort of dumb. Well, you go to a restaurant, and I mean, that the incident we just talked about in Monterey was a case in point. I mean, I did feel like a dope afterwards, and Clarissa, I was sort of the fool to go all that way and eat like ribs when you're overlooking like the Pacific Ocean in Monterey. But on the other hand, I have to say the things I like most in life, you know, are like writing, reading, hanging out with friends and stuff. They're not horribly expensive, so I don't feel like I don't feel like I've been deprived in my life, but there's definitely been times where being cheap has gotten in the way of having a good time, and it was silliness on my part.
Here's another call from Salt Lake City. Lara is on the line. Hi, Lara. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks, Jane. It's interesting listening to that. I grew up in a really conservative household, you know, like lower middle class and stuff, and it wasn't until I was in college myself and traveling and stuff that I realized that the way to be frugal or whatever is really to know what you want and then to be able to invest your money, like, not in terms of like stock market investments, but invest in like experiences and stuff, which you can't do unless you really know what you want. And I've learned that now, I'm a college graduate and I don't have a lot of money, but I know what experiences are worth something to me. You know, I know that I'm going to buy that $3 latte if I'm going to sit for 2 hours with my girlfriend in a coffee shop, and it's going to be a really great experience. You know, that's worth it to me. Mm. Maybe I won't go out to eat, like, you know, 4 times a month or a week or whatever. You know, maybe I will just go out to eat one time, but I'll go out with some really good friends, and we'll spend a lot of money, and we'll have an excellent meal, and we'll stay there for 3 hours, and it'll be a great memory afterwards, you know, and that's worth it to me. Mm. So I think for myself, like, I had to travel and learn a lot to be able to really make the most.
To come to that point. Lara, thanks. Clarissa, do you understand Neil's position? Do you understand where this comes from in him, this penny-pinching nature?
But let me go back to what Laura said real quick. That's one of the things that I have seen from the responses of readers. Men tend to, the ones that are cheapskates, they tend to look more at saving a buck no matter what. And, of course, I'm generalizing here. And the response I've heard from women, it's more like quality of life is important. Mm. You know, even if you can be frugal, but let's not go overboard. You know, let's spend some money to have some good memories. Mm. But anyway, going back to the question about understanding, Neil, yes, I have come to understand him a little bit more, but I think part of it is getting older. More than if you put me in this same position, let's say 20 years ago, I would say no, I still don't understand him. But you know, I think as you get older, for one thing, we don't have the expense of the children. Two of them are quite self-sufficient. Mm-hmm. Now, so you know, I don't have to spend on the kids' clothes or their social lives or whatever. So I don't have that expense either. So more of the money is for us to keep.
And that's evolved in its own way. Sheila is calling now from Galway, New York. Hi, Sheila. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you very much. Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I'm calling because I'm almost 80 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And I was brought up during the Depression when people ate all their food on their plate. My husband's the same age as I am, so he was brought up the same way. We saved money. When we were first married, we had what we call old attic. We still have some of the old attic in our house.
Mm-hmm.
But so we saved, and one of the things that we did was to invest in the stock market. So we saved a fair amount of money over the years. And all of a sudden, we don't have all the money that we had or we thought we had. I mean, some of the things have, you know, cut almost in half. Mm. So you think about, why should you be frugal? Why should you save when, bingo, the economy can fall apart? Mm. And so I actually went out and bought some flowers today, which I never would have done in the past, because it just seemed that, well, I've got the money now. Maybe it'd be worse tomorrow.
Better spend it while it's there. Sheila, thank you. Neil, what do you say to that?
Well, I think she's correct on that. I mean, I think there's a virtue to saving. And, you know, in the stock market and so forth, as bad as it looks right now, over time, I think you will do well. But there's an uncertainty about life, and none of us knows if we'll be around, you know, how much time we have on this earth, and you have to enjoy things as well.
So are there any penny-pinching decisions you would take back that you wish you could revise?
Oh, I guess the biggest thing would be the sort of eating out, you know, when we go out, that I've been too many times, I've been too fixated on trying to save money, and it can sort of cast a pall over a meal. I mean, one time, I don't know if I'd take it back, but Carissa certainly would take it back. One time, this was probably about 15 years ago, we traveled all the way from Michigan, where I was covering the auto industry for the Wall Street Journal, to California, our native state. And we stayed all the way at Motel 6s. I was so proud of myself. But we had some sort of – they were generally pretty good, actually, but in my mind at least. But we had one experience where we went to this Motel 6 in, somewhere in Montana, and they gave us a room that was only used by smokers. And it was the strongest smelling room I've ever had in my life. And so we had to go through two or three different rooms before, like, 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, we finally got a room to settle down in. So I don't know, Clarissa, do you remember that trip?
Oh, yes, I do. I remember all of them. Yes, it was pretty miserable. Plus, to save money, Neil usually would get one room for the whole family. And there were, you know, 3 kids and 2 adults. So he would offer to sleep on the floor, but I just couldn't let him do it for some crazy reason. And I would end up, you know, on the floor or with 2 kids or whatever, or end up on the little sofa. So it was miserable. So at one point, you just put your foot down and say, okay, this is ridiculous. Let's live.
Clarissa Templin, my heart is with you. You've made it this far. You can keep going.
Oh, but it's wonderful. I mean, I don't want to make it sound like it's a horrible life. Save me, please.
Clarissa Templin, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook. We're putting cheapskates, tightwads, and skinflints under the microscope this hour. Neil Templin is with me. He writes the Wall Street Journal's column, Cheapskate. And I want to introduce another guest as well now. Scott Rick is a postdoctoral fellow and lecturer at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. He's the co-author of an academic paper, Tightwads and Spendthrifts, which examines the emotional and neural underpinnings of the decision to spend money. Scott Rick, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. You wrote this academic paper. Tell us what you were trying to or hoping to discover in your work.
Well, we thought that the standard economic view of spending was probably too simple. And that view says that people are able to consider opportunity costs when making spending decisions. We can figure out the next best use of the money. When I'm trying to decide whether to buy the $4 latte, I can figure out the next best use of that money, and then sort of weigh the latte versus that next best use. We thought that was too simple, that people probably weren't capable of that kind of spontaneous, deep thinking. And what we thought is that people relied on sort of gut reactions, negative emotion, sort of as a proxy, a substitute for that more careful economic calculations. And so we had people, in another study, we had people shop while having their brain scanned with functional magnetic resonance imaging, fMRI. And we found that the more activation in the insula we observed, the less likely they were to spend. And the insula is the region that's typically active when people are experiencing distress. It's typically physical pain, but it's also emotional distress as well. And we said, well, it looks like people are relying on what we call a pain of paying to deter their spending. And in this paper on tightwads and spendthrifts, we sort of followed up on that. Our sort of intuition and observation in the real world was that, well, people really seem to differ in their tendency to experience this. We can think of people who really seem to experience it a lot, really find spending to be kind of an anxious event. And then other people who don't really experience it at all. And that's why we developed this little four-item scale to measure people's location on this dimension.
So who's happiest? Which end of the scale is a happier person? It's tightwads, well, spendthrifts? I mean, where does it fall?
Right. So there are three categories that we put people in, tightwads, spendthrifts, and then there are people in the middle who we call unconflicted. They experience some moderate amount of pain, but not too much, not too little. When we survey unmarried people, we find that unconflicted consumers are the happiest, and that tightwads and spendthrifts are equally unhappy.
So is this nurture or nature? I mean, are we born this way? Do we learn to become this way, which whatever end of the spectrum we're on?
Right. Well, I certainly agree with Neil's earlier point that sort of life circumstances can make you adapt in how you feel towards spending and saving. But I do think there's a big nature component. I think sort of the extent to which you are anxiety-prone kind of bounds how much sort of situational factors can move your feelings. Like if you're just not at all anxiety-prone and, you know, the situation is tight, there's only so much pain of paying you can muster up, I think. Within yourself.
We've just heard from Clarissa and Neil Templin, a married couple. I'm wondering about that, the money issues within a marriage. What did your study conclude about the unions of a cheapskate and a spendthrift?
Right. Well, this is a follow-up study that Deborah Small and Eli Finkel and I are doing. We're calling it Fatal Fiscal Attraction. We find that, pretty much across the board, when it comes to attraction, people tend to look for similars. We like people who are like ourselves. This is true everywhere except for things we don't like about ourselves. And if there's something you don't like about yourself, you tend to seek the opposite. And our earlier work suggested that tightwads and spendthrifts don't like being tightwads and spendthrifts, and so they tend to marry the opposite. We find that opposites attract in this domain. But this is ultimately bad news for marriages because this tends to, we find that it tends to produce arguments over money, and that, of course, diminishes marital well-being.
So what are the broad conclusions, then, of your work, Scott?
Well, it's, I guess the broad conclusion is that spending is a lot more emotional than sort of prior work, particularly work in economics, would have us think. And this has really important implications for what we spend and our sort of real world happiness and our relationships as well. But you can override the emotion. And I thought it was an interesting point that Neil said about, you know, he's writing the column now and he's a little less cheap when it comes to things, that he feels that he should be buying. And that's actually perfectly consistent with our framework. We say that it's normally too emotional, but if you can override it with cognition, tightwads should start to spend more and spendthrifts should start to spend less.
It is really fascinating research. It really is. Scott Rick, thank you so much. From Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, postdoctoral fellow and lecturer at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania. Scott, thank you.
Thank you.
Back to the phones now. Ray is on the line now from Charlottesville, Virginia. Hi, Ray. Welcome to the program, and thank you for waiting.
Yes, hi, Jane. Hi. No problems with weight. Neil and I are kindred spirits in a way. I had to laugh when I heard Scott say the pain and anxiety of spending. Well, boy, I definitely feel that when I'm spending. Mm. It's almost as if I'm doing something wrong. Mm. And unless I'm buying something that I actually really need versus something that I want, there's no anxiety. Mm. But, go out and just spend frivolously. You know, we were talking about cheapskates and penny pinchers. We're not that. We are just people who don't want to be wasteful.
Hmm. Neil, and what do you think about the caller's comments?
Well, I know that feeling. I know feeling anxious, like just sort of, I don't know, just sort of a bad feeling. Like, why am I buying this thing that I don't need, or why am I spending more than I need to? It just, it's like the feeling like money just fell out of your pocket in the street. You didn't pick it up or something. You're doing something wrong. And I'm not, believe me, I've gotten so many emails. I'm not the most, I've experienced some of that anxiety, but not as much as many of the people that write in. And I always viewed it as sort of being cheap and frugal, as the caller does, as being sort of a positive attribute. When you talk to people like Scott Rick, they then start talking about it as a form of neurotic behavior, which was sort of an eye-opener for me. Mm. So,
well, behavior aside, and all of what Scott spoke about aside, in this economy, we need less penny-pinching, do we not, to stimulate economic growth? Do you ever write about that, and how do readers respond to that notion?
Yeah, because I had a reader once come after me and basically say you know, you're so. All you do is talk about not spending money. What's it like for your family? She went on to say, would they just experience maybe just a little bit of relief when you die? And so I wrote a whole column on that. You know, I had to agree with her at times. There are times where I've made them a little bit miserable, or it's been a little unpleasant, though.
Your son actually gave you a flip answer, which you wrote about in the column as well.
Well, yeah, I asked my son sitting at the table as he shoveled eggs into his face, would you be happy if I died? And he said, depends how much money you have, and then resumed shoveling eggs. But that just proves he's a wise guy like me. I mean, the bottom line is, no, I don't think my family would be happy if I died. It's not miserable to that extent. But I mean, I think it's a fine line. It's a very fine line, and we have spent too much as a society. It is part of the reason we're in this mess right now. There are many reasons, but that's one of them. And yet, if it's, you know, the old paradox of thrift, if nobody spends, if everybody's too tight, it'll be harder for us to dig our way out of this mess. Matter of fact, the best circumstance is for you to spend and for me to save. Then the economy will do better, but I'll be perfectly positioned. So it's one of those things.
Back to the phones now. Jason is in Shoreham, New York. Jason, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jan.
Hi. Go ahead.
I just wanted to point out that, you know, oftentimes, you know, I'll need a service or a product, and it'll be something that I'll need or I'll want that'll improve my life in some way.
Mm-hmm.
And let's say it's something that I've seen advertised for $100. If I spend some time researching, I can go out and maybe find the item for $50, a big savings. Mm. And that spending that time and then getting that savings is almost like an addiction. It's like a thrill of being able to save a bunch of money and beating out all the retailers.
Hmm.
And I think that's a great feeling, and that's one of the reasons that I love to save money is the addiction.
Jason, thank you. Here's the other side of the coin from Susan, who's in Roanoke, Virginia. Susan, welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
How are you?
Hi, fine. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to give another twist on all this, and I know that we're talking about being tight and saving money and money's important, but you know, I tend to come from a very generous home and I tend to have a generous heart, and I know that I've been with many people that are cheap and it's really cost relationships with me, because after a while of giving and them taking, it is unfortunately ended a lot of relationships that could have been wonderful, and I'm not just talking about opposite gender. I'm talking about, you know, friends, even family. Even family, you know, the older I get, the wiser I get. And, you know, you can treat for so long, but then if somebody else doesn't treat in return after a while, you just, you know, you throw up your hands and say, you know, I'm not teaching them anything. It's like you can't teach them anything like I thought when I was young I could.
Hmm. Susan, I appreciate your call. Neil Templin, does this ring true with you?
Yeah, well, when I'm advocating being cheap, I'm saying let's do something that's not that expensive, not let's do something really nice and you pay for it and I'm a freeloader. So, I mean, it just, as everything else, there's sort of a balance, but for sure don't think the right way to be cheap is to have the other person always pay for everything. I believe in paying my share, but just I may push us towards things that just don't cost as much, towards a cheaper restaurant or towards getting my books at the library instead of Barnes & Noble or whatever.
George is calling from Boston. George, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I remember when I was watching TV when the economy sort of began its downturn, and people were being interviewed about what they have to do to save money and preserve their money when the gas prices were sort of going through the roof. And I remember, this is anecdotal, everybody said, well, I've had to start going to restaurants less, and I have to eat leftovers and bring food to work with me. And I remember every time I'd hear this on the radio or on TV, and my wife and I would sort of roll our eyes and look at each other, thinking that, you know, things like carpooling and having leftovers and not throwing away, you know, massive amounts of food is something that so many people have already been doing as just a regular way of operating. And we rely on things like this, I don't know what I call it, the secondary market, like Craigslist and eBay, for, you know, tons of items. I remember I was at a table I wanted to send up to my sister a couple hundred miles away, so I went on Craigslist and I found the rideshare section where people say where they're going and you can get a ride with them. You pay for a little bit of gas, and I called the guy up and he delivered the table to my sister for a few dollars. Saved probably $200 in you know, freight.
The way of life, George. Thanks so much. Neil Templin, I wish you'd tell us the story about, well, it probably is my favorite among your columns in the Wall Street Journal, the dog food story and the knee surgery, and the moral of the story being sometimes cheapskateness costs you money.
Right. And it definitely does. And about 4 or 5 years ago, I was carrying a container of dog food from my garage. I was living in Dallas at the time, to the house. And my beagle, Andy the Beagle, was following along as he always follows whenever I transport food. And I tripped over a garden hose, and I had a split-second decision, which was either put my hands down and break my fall, or try to not spill the container of dog food, which had several days worth of dog food. So I tried to save the dog food and came crashing down onto my left knee and got a fracture of my kneecap, which was painful. And my knee still, you know, I had to wear a brace for like 6 weeks, and my knee still doesn't, it's okay, but it's not like it was before. And of course, the worst part of it was, I let go of the dog food when I hit the pavement, and Andy scarfed down like a, you know, 3 days worth of dog food while I sit there when I sat there in agony on my knee. So
and a lot of readers loved that one, related a lot to that story, actually, in all seriousness.
They did, and I wrote a column the next week in which readers told me about crazy things they had done to try to save money. I think like one guy in Alaska had forgotten a package of crackers at the store when in really bad weather, and so he drove back to get him and then got in some crash where nobody was hurt, but he like totaled his vehicle. And so it definitely, you can say it costs yourself more than you're saving by trying to be ultra cheap.
Are there any ways that you are not cheap?
There definitely are. As I said, I'm not as cheap as some of the people that I hear from, but also I think this is true of most people, is that people are cheap on some things and not on others. Like home repairs, for example. I'm not very handy, but I don't try real hard to learn how to be handy, and so I'll pay someone to come in, and I try not to overpay, but I'll pay them, you know, whatever the standard prices to have a job done that I could probably do myself, like if we're redoing our kitchen or whatever. So I think everybody is like this, even people that think they're really cheap. I had a guy one time, we were talking about how much is a dog's life worth and how much will you spend on medical care for your dog when it gets sick. It can be thousands of dollars now. And this guy told me, I spent $120 to get my dog when I bought it from the vet, from the shelter, and that's all I'll spend to save its life. And then he went on to say, and I'm getting ready to spend $60,000 to get a new swimming pool. So everybody's cheap in some areas and not in others.
Neil Templin is the personal finance editor at the Wall Street Journal. He writes the Wall Street Journal's weekly Cheapskate column, which started in 2008. Neil, thanks so much for your time.
It's been a pleasure.
You can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.